Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Greenhorns, this is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio. Radio for young farmers by young farmers. It is spring. Well, it feels like spring. Let's cross our fingers that it is spring. And you never can tell these days, but I'm hoping so. And there's as a result, everyone's busy and got their heads focused and working so hard, getting themselves ready for the season, as I'm sure you are too. I'm on the call today with Justin from Burt Rock Farm in Vermont. Are you there?
I am here, Severin.
How are you doing up there?
I'm doing pretty well. I still have snow on the ground. I don't know about you.
Oh, well, it depends where you are, because we just were up there in Michigan, and there was blizzards and snow, and
yep.
Then we were down in, there's in Kentucky, and it's already way spring. So now,
yep.
I'm back in New York State, and it feels very warm. Do you have warm air?
It's fairly warm when the sun's out, but we're kind of in the clouds a lot today. They're kind of piling up against the greens, and we're right. Our farm's right at the bottom of the main spine of the Green Mountains, so the clouds tend to hang for a little bit. The only thing that's not a south face for us right now is still snow covered.
Your farm, and in Vermont, what's going on around you in Vermont?
What's going around is a lot of the sugar houses are boiling sap, the roads are turning to mush, and the greenhouses are all hooked up and burning propane, which is exciting and nerve-wracking on these nights when it gets down to 0 degrees.
So let's hear about what you produce there in your operation in the world and what's being produced on either side of you or kind of around you in the valley there.
Right, well, I'm in Huntington, which is 25 miles southeast of Burlington, right up against the mountains. And we're on the banks of the Huntington River, so it's all old glacial terraces, which is very beautiful and grows very good vegetables. And we do, this year we'll be cropping about 7 acres of mostly wholesale organic vegetables for sale in the Burlington area and then some down in Boston. And we specialize in winter storage crops, and then some greenhouse crops in the summer, like eggplant, as well as a fair amount of baby spinach from the fields. And, but our biggest crop is sweet potatoes.
So you're apparently very famous for your sweet potatoes. I just wanted to know why you decided to go the route of wholesale. If you started in more towards direct sales and then evolved your business to more wholesale, or if you, from the beginning, decided that wholesale was the way.
No, well, I started with wholesale because when we bought the farm, I was managing another farm in the next town over, so I didn't really have time to go to markets. So my business plan was kind of developed around growing storage crops for wholesale because I could grow those nights and weekends while I was managing this other farm, put them in storage, and sell them during the winter when I had more time. So I do one winter farmer's market, and that's all the retailing that I do.
Got it. Well, that's really very interesting. That's very similar to my friend Ben Abel in Kentucky. His day job was running the CSA farm at the University of Kentucky, and then his his nights and weekends were spent running a wholesale organic vegetable business.
Jeez.
So that's funny.
I never had to deliver anything until October at least, whereas it sounds like your friend down there had to hawking some tomatoes in the middle of the main season.
The thing that's interesting also is, like, if we're talking about this regional food system and, you know, progressively moving out from the lowest hanging fruit, which is selling vegetables at a premium to people who are willing to pay for them by schlepping them there ourselves, And
right.
then thinking more in terms of the complexity of our modern world, and making it so that more and more of the food that's moving through that system is moving through that system guided by the principles of sustainable production and sustainable, mm-hmm. Equitable sharing of the parts of the pie. Obviously, getting more into wholesale markets is a major part of that. I wonder if you have any kind of practical or philosophical reflections on what changes when you enter one layer of remove with your product.
Well, that's kind of why I still like doing the one winter farmers market, because most of the year I talk to, you know, 5 or 6 produce buyers, and that's about it. You know, at the stores that I sell to, and that I sell to a couple different multi-farm CSAs. So the winter farmers market, at least I get to interact with, you know, some of the people who are the end consumers of the produce we've grown, which is, you know, very rewarding. And it's something I don't get for most of the year, you know, while we're just growing storage crops and spinach. But
so you
it
like
was
it.
Also practical on my part, because in northwest Vermont, where I am, it's a pretty mature local food scene. You know, you can't. There aren't too many farmers markets in the summer that you could join and actually sell $1,000 worth of product at. You know, they're all pretty full. They're pretty well served by a lot of really talented growers. So it was a practical decision on my part to do mostly wholesaling, because I knew there were bigger holes in the market there. And my background was in growing on a, you know, decent sized scale as compared to, you know, the 5 acres I'm doing now. So to scale up from 0 to like 7 acres of vegetables was kind of built into the training I already had.
And now you're at 7 acres of vegetables. Are you planning on going bigger, or are you kind of staying?
Yeah, I probably need to,
for
cash flow reasons, I probably need to plateau up around 12 acres of actual vegetables, you know, perhaps more, but we're somewhat land limited over here because it's so mountainous. But, you know, that would be my ideal goal, because right now we own and have access to about 12 acres of good, you know, high-quality vegetable land. And, you know, I'd obviously need more than that if I were to grow 12 acres of vegetables. I'm always kind of hunting around for, you know, some more land leasing opportunities.
Okay, so before we go forward into the future and you describe why 12 acres makes sense to you as the right amount of land to work with the equipment and markets that you have, can you talk about what got you to the point where you feel comfortable to be growing 7 acres and thinking more? Just like starting in year one of agriculture, how step by step it got you to the point where you are, but in a short way.
Sure. I grew up in Hudson Valley in New York, about a half hour southeast of Albany in Columbia County, where I think you guys have a bunch of friends. And just by accident, I started working at the farm, which was only a couple miles from my parents' house, called Roxbury Farm, which a lot of people in the Northeast will know is a pretty well-established, you know, very well-run organic vegetable operation. They were the first CSA farm down in New York City. So when I was there 10 years ago, they were growing about probably 35 acres of vegetables, another 35 acres of cover crops every year. So I kind of learned how to do farming to the extent to which I learned it on a pretty sizable operation to start off with. So all my benchmarks were kind of pinned to this fairly mechanized, larger-scale system. So I worked there for 4 years, and I went back to grad school to get a degree in soil science. And after that, my future wife and I moved to Vermont, where she's from. And we bought a farm. After being here for a year managing another farm, we bought a place 10 miles down the road from our parents' house. And so in our first year of being here, all I did was plow the ground, because I was still managing another farm. And I kind of slowly transitioned out of managing that other farm and got our farm up and running. So I didn't have a lot of the price pressures that a lot of people might have if they're trying to make a living off of, you know, diving in to farming in their first year on their own place. Because when you do that, you often chase those kind of low-hanging fruits of, you know, farmers markets because they're available. But they might not necessarily be good for your business long-term, because there's kind of a price ceiling on how much you can earn if you're doing farmers markets on a small scale. So I built up some relationships with some of the local produce buyers around here, like at City Market in Burlington and Healthy Living in South Burlington and the Interbell Food Hub in Burlington. We developed a relationship mostly around sweet potatoes and onions. And as the years have progressed, we've been able to expand our offerings. And, you know, we have some great produce.
And so you're talking about this all in a very nice, straightforward, science, matter-of-fact kind of way. And I wondered if you would tackle also the straightforward way that you approach the soil that you chose to farm on. Obviously, being so close to your wife's parents is a very smart, logical decision. Doesn't hurt that there's great soil there. The rigor of a master's program on soil science and mm-hmm. the kind of expert level or bottom level of expert level of understanding of soil as a medium is mm-hmm. something that not all of us who are entering farming come with.
Right.
What do you think is the shortcut to getting that, or else slash, do you feel like it gives you super special powers?
Well, shortcuts are usually probably not the best avenues to take if you want a really great result in the end. But when I was working down at Roxbury, we had this nice system where every day we'd start harvesting at 6, and then we'd take an hour breakfast from 8 till 9, and then we'd take an hour lunch from 1 to 2, and then work again until 5 or so. So that's 2 hours of short amounts of time where you don't necessarily need to spend all that time eating. It doesn't take an hour to eat breakfast. The work day there had a lot of breaks in it, so I was able to do a lot of reading. And the farm I was at had a lot of textbooks, more or less, about soils. So that's kind of where that was coming from.
Oh, I see. So you got started in your soil study during your lunch break, and then you
Yeah, laying on the couch reading, you know, The Nature and Property of Soils by Brady and Weil, that sort of thing.
And then the geek inside you overtook your life, and you had to go to school for how many years?
And for what was that?
How long does it take to get a degree in soil science?
It takes 2 to 2.5 years, you know, depending on your research projects. But mine took me 2.5 because I had to wrap up some field seasons. So I took a two-season break from farming for grad school. By the end of grad school, I was like, oh, I can't wait to get back to farming. And it was great. It was a great hiatus, and I saved a lot of money in grad school. And then we moved up here.
What was the outcome of your research project, or what did you focus on? And does that relate at all to what you're working on now, what kind of soils you're working with now?
Yeah, my research, I was in the horticulture department working on soils, and I was researching winter nitrogen dynamics in the soil. So what happens to nitrogen in the soil during the time of the year when stuff isn't growing actively? So I was doing my research actually in silage corn, which is only in the ground for 4 months out of the year. So for 8 months out of the year, silage corn fields are just, you know, bare fields with a little bit of stubble. So we were researching what happens with the nitrogen during the winter. And turns out a lot of it disappears, which was already somewhat fairly well known.
Well, it turns out it's highly mobile in the environment and it's contaminating
all
of our streams.
Yeah. And all those microbes in the soil are still mineralizing it even when it's like 33 degrees down there.
That's
basically, if you could wrap up what I was studying, it's, you know, plant cover crops, you know, prevent soil nudity, that sort of thing.
So that is a shortcut for you.
What's that?
There's a shortcut for you, plant cover crops.
Yeah, yeah. And as Harold Vaness says, prevent soil nudity.
So this brings up kind of another meta question, which is, If one of the main projects of humanity is to restore and revive the biology of our agricultural soils such that they will resist the degradation and erosion and stick around and grow and be strong enough and healthy enough to provide for food for the future, maybe it makes sense for many, many hundreds of thousands of more of us to go and study soil science, seeing as how the condition of our soils are so bad, and maybe the government should even be paying for there to be more soil scientists.
Huh, well, I guess I can't say much about that, but I mean the latter part, but maintaining the biological health of your soils is absolutely paramount to long-term success on any piece of ground, and enhancing it into a condition that was hopefully better than you found it. We were blessed on our farm that it was in hay before we got it. So in terms of organic matter, it had really high organic matter. A lot of the nutrients were very deficient, but it's easy to add nutrients. It's hard to add organic matter. You know, it had really good structure to it.
Lucky dog.
You know, everything we can do to increase, increase the water holding capacity of our soils, the nutrient holding capacity of our soils, and
resilience of the soil being one of the best investments you can make for your long-term success as a farmer, equally could probably be said for our civilization. And then you were saying how lucky you are to have such nice soil where you are.
Yeah, well, it's nice soil, but it was nice soil that was in hay, so it hadn't been, plowed and plowed and plowed and plowed and plowed in the recent past, which is, very good, because now I'm doing a fair amount of plowing on it, so it's nice to have.
And because you were walking into that land that had been in hay and had good structure to it, and you had a really thorough and really good respect for the soil, you probably invested in some equipment that was less destructive of soil structure. Like, you maybe don't do that much rototilling, or could you reflect on your equipment choices?
I do not own a rototiller. I do, like I said before, we're pretty mechanized. But I vegetable farm kind of like a old-time corn grower. Like, I still use a three-bottom plow and disc harrows and field cultivators because it doesn't quite do that egg beater thing that rototillers do on the soil.
So let's talk about what are those egg beaters doing, because we probably have some soil science beginners listening to us.
Right, right.
Also some agribusiness
rototillers,
executives.
Rototillers are a fantastic way of getting residue incorporated very quickly. So in the past, a farmer would come in and plow a field with a, a 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 bottom plow, then cut it up with a disc harrow, and then level it with springtine harrows or S-tine harrows, something like that. And that process takes about 4 weeks. A rototiller can come in and do that in one pass, and then you might have to do it again in a couple days. But you use kind of soil violence as a way to shave down the time it takes to get ground ready. And so, and a lot of times, it's definitely the right thing to do. But those egg beaters slice up the soil so much, and they break up all the aggregates in the soil. So if you do this, hundreds of times, eventually all those aggregates, which, allow air to infiltrate, allow water to drain, they start to break down. So in my system, I'm breaking up aggregates too, but I like to think I'm doing it at a slower rate. But it just relies you to, it requires you plan quite a bit more because you have to wait, 4 weeks to get on a piece of ground because you have to plow it and then disc it and harrow it.
And then within the plow and the disc and the harrow, or even way that you're shaping beds, are you aware or do you tune into conversations about, the speed with which you're moving through the field or the angle upon which you're turning the piece of ground, or other ways where the technology is really organized and oriented around preserving soil quality?
I guess I'd answer that by saying if you do it right, you only have to do it once. And if you have to do it once, you're doing a lot less damage than if you do it twice. So if you plow at the right speed, you'll turn over your furrows the right way. If you go too fast, they'll kind of get splayed out. If you go too slow, they won't roll over. And if you don't have your disc harrow set up right, you just have to kind of make too many passes, and passes cause compaction and breaking down of soil aggregates and waste diesel fuel.
It sounds so simple and easy, and yet the question is always, how long does it take to learn these skills? How long does it take, realistically, with somebody watching you or not watching you, to get into that cherry spot of being like, I have confidence that I can move this machine at the right speed most of the time. I feel ready to move on to the next phase of my farming career where there's nobody fact-checking me.
Well, I see it would be difficult to me to say, for me to say anybody's really ready to run their own operation until they've been farming at least 5 years for somebody else who's, pretty skilled at what they do. And, some conversations I've had with some farmers who, 20, 30 years older than me say they think it's 10 years. But, it all depends on the individual, too. A lot of people are fast learners and can intuit a lot of it. But a lot of people are getting into this business without enough experience, and, I think it harms them long-term because, there's a lot of skills that are much better learned on somebody else's payroll.
Well, and I think that the flip side of that piece of advice is if you're feeling antsy that you aren't in control of your destiny yet and you're still working for someone else, and it's hard for you, then maybe get a winter job that earns a lot or get yourself into a state of proficiency for a supplemental income profession. And don't worry so much about the fact that you can't afford land because maybe you're not ready for it yet either. And you can save yourself the heartache by accepting that fact and getting a little bit humble and saying, oh, well, I've got another 4 or 5 years to put into my training as a farmer before I need to take that leap. So
yeah, money is very, very helpful. Absolutely.
Money is helpful. Noted.
Money is very helpful. I mean, it takes many tens of thousands of dollars to, you know, buy the equipment to grow a couple acres of vegetables. You know, unless you have 20 people at hand who can do the work by hand. But most farmers I talk to say labor is a problem. So, you know, it's hard to find enough good helpers.
So, in your off season, what is occupying your time, or what is driving your? Where are you doing your other thinking?
Well, I don't really have a proper off season because I do 85% of my sales between October 1st and April 1st. So I spend the summer growing and harvesting, and then I put most of the stuff into storage, and then break it out, you know, starting sometime in September, and start doing my weekly. I don't even do any deliveries really until September. So it kind of takes, you know, my summers are nowhere near as hectic as most vegetable farmers because I don't go to farmers markets. I do a few spinach deliveries a week, but those are pretty mellow. So in the winter, it's a lot of washing and packing and delivering of, you know, sweet potatoes, winter squash, onions, carrots, beets. It's kind of nice, though, because it's just not as, you know, it's not as flat out as it is in August for people who are growing tomatoes and eggplants and everything else.
Well, so, and it also, you know, a lot of growers, well, as more consumers and restaurants and everybody is wanting to eat more regionally, and if we're all serious about growing more regionally overall, it seems like your business model is likely to be a more common one moving forward. Do you feel like there is ample business opportunity to focus on storage vegetables as a primary outcome of your operation?
I think so. The problem with storage vegetables, though, is it does require a fair amount of infrastructure. You know, you have to have the facilities to store stuff properly. And there's about 5 different storage zones that you'd need to cover the full suite of vegetables that you can store in the winter. So, you know, we took out a home equity loan, you know, last fall and built a 1,000-square-foot sweet potato storage barn. And, you know, so you have to put the money in, but, you know, up here there's great markets for it. So I imagine that's probably the case in lots of other places too. But everybody's markets are very different. And like I said, we're lucky up here to have a very supportive community of food consumers and retailers to work with. And that might not be the case, you know, if you're in somewhere else.
Okay, so I love it to know a little more about the root storage. I feel like people are just heads around some of the logistics in root storage and even coordinating on a low budget different storage zones and even programming little Arduinos to manage humidity, temperature, et cetera, remotely and like have an emergency backup in case it starts freezing and stuff like that. Do you want to talk a little bit about your system that you set up and where you got the information to design it?
Yeah, well, all the information on how to store crops, I mean, that stuff is very available just in a simple internet search. But sweet potatoes are kind of an odd vegetable in that they need to be kept hot and humid. So the barn we have for them is kept at 55 degrees and 85% humidity all winter. You know, whereas if you're storing onions, you want them to be 32 degrees and dry. So, obviously, they have to be in different places. But the building we put up, I actually divided it into 2 insulated rooms, and both have radiant heat in the floor. And so, one room I actually
and
kept
you,
for potatoes.
Do you have fans going in them, or like what do you? How do you keep it continuously 85 degrees in the whole room?
55 degrees.
Sorry, 55.
It's a propane on-demand water heater. And we our sweet potato harvest this year is about 40,000 pounds, and that took 60 gallons of propane to keep warm all winter. So it's really, really very low fossil fuel use, especially compared to my delivery truck or my greenhouse. But
wow.
You know, it's a very conventional building. It's just super insulated walls, an insulated floor, concrete with, you know, radiant heat in the floor, and it's all hooked up to an on-demand propane hot water heater, which works great. I'd recommend that system to anybody who's looking, you know, to do a new construction. Obviously, pretty hard to retrofit something with radiant heat.
And you never found other, you know, you just figured out what the conditions were based on the internet, and then just built cooled and heated structures. How do you maintain humidity?
If you have 40,000 pounds of sweet potatoes in a 600-square-foot room, it will maintain humidity on its own just because of the evaporation from the roots. But if you need to, raise the humidity in a radiant floor system, you just spray water on the floor and it evaporates. Your problem is often going to be excess humidity if you have that much stuff in that small space.
But, in which case, you create a vent out?
What's that?
So if you have excess humidity, you put in a dehumidifier and you put in a vent and blow air through?
Yeah, it just depends. If you can have a vent that, you know, exhausts the air out and sucks in cooler, drier air, or you can just use a dehumidifier and dump the water every other day. Yeah, I mean, there's really high-tech ways and low-tech ways. The way I did it is kind of mid-tech, I guess it would be. In the past, we built an insulated room in our basement of our house that we used to keep the sweet potatoes in, but we kind of outgrew that. And that was very low-tech. That was a space heater.
I was trying to provoke you to identify some resources where people can read growers' perspectives and strategies on roof storage, because that was a question that came up last week for somebody who was, you know, working on getting their storage situation set up and was like, there must be a book somewhere about cold storage.
Huh.
And all the options and all the different doodads and gadgets that you can use. And I said, I don't know about that book. So
yeah, it
I seems
guess like
you don't know
about
it.
The books that are out there are either for, like, home gardeners. So, like, you know, I think there's a couple books out there about, you know, root cellars. And then there's, you know, extension manuals from North Carolina State about how to build a 2 million bushel sweet potato facility. You know, so I feel like in the middle there's probably not as much really good information in a book that I knew off the top of my head. But, you know, a lot of this stuff is on the internet, and then, a lot of agricultural stuff is definitely deficient on the internet, but that's one thing that I think there is a fair amount of. And just ask around people who are already doing it.
Yeah, I told that person who asked me, I said, go look through the conference proceedings of all the regional ag conferences, sustainable ag conferences around you, and if there was one that was about root storage,
yeah,
call up that farmer.
I mean, a book that I'd recommend for any aspiring vegetable farmer, period, is, what's it called? Knott's Handbook for Vegetable Growers. It's like a 450-page medium-sized paperback. It's super expensive, but it's pretty much got all the numbers you need on growing vegetables, like expected yields, how much nitrogen they need, what storage conditions they need. And that, I mean, that's a great book. I got that for Christmas, like, probably 10 years ago, and it's, you know, very well worn already.
Awesome. Any other resources or unexpected sources of good ideas that you wanted to highlight from your? You make it sound so easy. It's almost depressing.
The best resource is obviously your smartest farm friend. I make a habit of picking the brains of my friends who I know are better than I am at all these different things, and so I just kind of pick their brain until they get annoyed. I mean, that's the best resource most of us have, I imagine.
And then giving them some beer so they don't get annoyed by it.
Well, that's how you get the information. Yeah, absolutely. You just show up at their farm with a six-pack.
Well, you heard it here first. your strategy for success. If you wanted to show up for some other things, I have some announcements. I wanted to say thank you to Justin for his awesome Q&A here and to all of our listeners. The events that are continuing to occur are much, much slower than they are at other times of the year because everybody is too busy to do anything. So most of the events are postponed until later in the season. So I'll tell you about one, which is the Equinox Grange Hall Dance. We're having on June 21st at the Grange Hall in Williamsburg, New York. It's a dress ball, and we're going to be building a boat and making all sorts of headdresses and things and a chandelier for the Grange and cooking all day the day before. So if you're considering planning ahead for a little jaunt out into the world, consider the Equinox Ball at the Williamsburg Grange Hall. And that's it. If you haven't already ordered your new Farmer's Almanac, it's 400 pages. It's retardedly amazing. And you can order yours for $20 or get a feed store or bookstore or any kind of people who are in the new economy of young farmers wanting to distribute it to get a little box of 10, and then you get them wholesale. Or you can order them wholesale for your CSA and distribute them as you like. Preview is online on our website, and I look forward to talking to you all next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.